Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, there are approximately 60,000 veterans in Columbus, many of whom have recently transitioned back to civilian life, and some are struggling to assimilate into the civilian workforce. Jay Fox will speak with an expert on that topic. He'll also chat with experts about the mental health of Gen Z and online reputations. First up on Columbus Perspective,
Ohio has over 700,000 veterans, and Columbus is home to 60,000 of them. An estimated 180,000 service members transition to civilian life annually, according to the Department of Labor. While veterans play a vital role in our communities and societies, they continue to face significant obstacles when entering the workforce. Lindsay Streeter is the Senior Vice President of Global Military Affairs at Bank of America and a retired Command Sergeant Major from the Army, 31 years of service, and we thank you for your service. Lindsay joins us now on Columbus Perspective. How are you, sir?
Hey, Jay, I'm doing well. How are you, sir?
I am well. Why are veterans having problems entering the workforce?
You know, Jay, what we found is the overwhelming problem that plagues our veterans as they transition is the translation of their skills, those skills that they've acquired while in the military. The opportunity lies in the jargon. Veterans do a myriad of jobs, but they're written in specific military jargon, and it's difficult for them to translate those skill sets and overlay them with opportunities in the civilian workforce.
Now, all kidding aside, wouldn't you think that there would be a Google translator that would be able to transfer this knowledge into their own language?
Yeah, and most branches of the military have a transitional program that does, in fact, do the translation for them. The problem you run into is that it's the first time that that veteran is seeing or reading about themselves in that way, and sometimes they don't have the confidence to represent themselves in that manner on the job interview. And so they're seeing that new language and understanding those new skill sets for the first time. That discovery learning is sometimes intimidating for them. So we want to have the patience to help them there.
Sometimes the public assumes that if you have served in the military, your best route for employment would be the police department, the sheriff's office, a corrections facility of some kind, but that's not accurate. What other types of employment are available to veterans?
Yeah, Jay, those are the obvious choices. And again, it comes with veterans not really understanding the skills that they bring to the table. Once they fully unpack their skill sets, the door is wide open for them. You know, they bring skills to the table such as leadership, teamwork, communications. They can problem solve. Their work ethic is impeccable. Integrity, adaptability, and all sorts of management skills. And so you couple that with the time served and maybe add a little education or some upskilling and the sky's the limit for MJ.
Well, we like to say thank you for your service when we see members of the military, either in uniform or those that we know that have served, but we can do more than thank them for their service. What can employers do to make that transition easier when they're trying to enter civilian workplace?
You know, Jay, most employers want to present themselves as being veteran-friendly. They want to open the door and allow veterans in. I think if you really want to make some progress in the veteran space, you want to demonstrate your company's ability to be veteran-ready. So you want to have some programs and processes in place to help them to onboard, to assimilate, to adapt to the culture and environment that they found themselves in. You want to have an ERG program in place to help them to find a place that they can network with people that have their interests in mind. You want to have a dedicated teammate that may help them should a life event occur that's kind of specific but unique to a veteran. So those are some of the things that organization can do to help veterans to assimilate and to feel more comfortable as they make that transition.
Bank of America is one of the largest banking institutions in the United States, and they had a goal of hiring 10,000 veterans, and that goal came in ahead of schedule. Why was that mandate to hire those veterans so important to this company?
Yeah, you know, our CEO looked at this seemingly insurmountable number when it came to unemployment. Veteran unemployment was about four times the national average, and wanted to do something about it when that pledge was made. And so what one of the first things we did was hire a veteran recruiter, someone that could understand the veteran population, that could read a resume, unpack the skill sets, meet and collaborate with hiring managers, and help to hire and bring veteran talent into the company. That's just one of the things. The other thing we did was we spent some time investing in their onboarding and assimilation. We wanted to make sure that they made it through the fits and jerks of transitioning. I know for me, I was fearful when I joined the Army, but I was horrified when it came time to leave. And so finding a place or an organization that receives you with open arms, and then when you get there, finding a culture that's ready to accept you as a veteran, those are paramount to any veteran that's transitioning success.
A lot of those veterans that were hired by Bank of America ended up working in the state of Ohio, Central Ohio to be specific. And even though you are not in Ohio, you had that same process after 31 years in the Army. What did you learn through that process, and what skills translated to your success?
You know, I learned, first of all, that I didn't have to be a banker to find something to do here at Bank of America. I also learned that I had skills that could be easily applied, readily applied to my employment here at the company. I knew that early on that my manager valued my previous leadership ability. I knew that I could demonstrate my ability to fit into a team and collaborate. I just needed to understand the business acumen and the language here at Bank of America. I knew that the values that the Army had instilled within me meshed perfectly with Bank of America's core values. I knew that I could bring work ethic to the table, and I was going to have integrity. So those are some of the things that helped me along the way, Jay, with my transition.
And I'm sure that when you speak to people who are serving in the military and about to get out, you've shared that story with them as they look for employment.
Yes, absolutely. Every opportunity that I get to engage a veteran or a military family in transition, I try to impart with them a little knowledge, but more importantly, just hope that they can trust our society, that our society is going to look out for them as veterans. There's going to be opportunities, and that their service is valued and it matters.
We want to thank Lindsey Streeter, Senior Vice President of Global Military Affairs at Bank of America, for helping us shed some light on the issue of hiring veterans and their skill sets and how to translate things into their own language so that the transition becomes easier. For Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's Jay Fox.
We're recording this interview on October 10th, which is World Mental Health Day, and we're paying particular attention to a generation of people in crisis. That group is called Gen Z. These are individuals born between 1997 and 2012. It is estimated that there are over 150,000 Gen Zers in the Columbus area, and half the population qualifies as either Gen Z or millennial. At Specific Issue is a new study that found that more than 3 out of every 4 of these individuals do not feel prepared to succeed in either college or a career, and a significant number question whether they can manage adulthood. Joining us now is Romy Drucker, director of the education program at the Walton Family Foundation. They invest more than $250 million annually in programs to help individuals like these find their unique path and purpose. Welcome, Romy. How are you?
Hi, Jay. Thank you so much for having me.
This is such an important topic because so many people are affected. What does the new survey data tell us specifically about Gen Z as it pertains to their mental health?
Well, the headline is that our young people need us now more than ever before. This survey and many surveys show that young people are struggling with their mental health. Only 20% of young people in this survey rate their mental health as excellent, and so we need to be paying extra attention. As you also mentioned, young people don't feel prepared for their future, and so we need to focus on how school is a place that unlocks that potential in young people.
So part of the study said something that caught my attention, and I'm going to ask this question based on that. If 79% of those surveyed say they felt optimistic about the future, doesn't that contradict their feelings of not being able to succeed?
I think one of the great things about this generation is that they are hopeful about their future. They're just asking us as adults to listen and give them the tools to succeed. So we need to be focused on solutions, on making school a place that equips young people with the skill sets and mindsets to succeed, because they actually believe they can.
Well, when you think about what happens at school, whether it is elementary, middle, high school, or the collegiate or post-secondary experience, there are all kinds of things that are focused on physical health. So we have PE classes, we have gym, we have athletic events. But what level of importance does mental health play in a student's ability to thrive and then go on to have a successful adult life, career, whatever they choose?
This survey with Gallup, and in my conversations with young people, what we see is that young people are saying they want school, and especially high school, to feel relevant. They want to feel a sense of purpose in school, and that is a key factor in supporting their mental well-being. So high schools that help young people tap into their passions, that help them experiment, that expose them to careers, are places that are motivating young people and helping them see what's possible in their future. More experiences like that can make a really big difference to the well-being of this generation.
So it's not just having a rap counselor who is on property to help when there's a crisis. It's about being proactive about the future, correct?
Obviously, having an adult that you can talk to and who you trust is really important, and school is a place where those relationships should be strong. However, I would also say that classwork and the actual academic experience should also be enriching, should feel to young people like it's setting them up for the kind of work they're going to do in college and also in their future careers.
My youngest daughter is 24. She qualifies as a Gen Zer, and she has a very different perspective about her relationship with her boyfriend and what she does for a living. What did the study find most Gen Zers define as relational or career success in the 21st century?
They want to have a comfortable life, and also, you know, even maybe more than wealth, they value finding meaning in their work. So we need to give them experiences to help them figure out what's going to create that for them. We want every young person to be on a path to success in life, which means having a stable career. But also, we want them to do something that makes them feel a sense of pride. That's what they're saying is the thing that really makes the difference for them in life. So I hope your daughter is having luck and it has the right experiences around her to help find that.
One of the things that we decided to do as parents with our children was focus on their particular path, what had meaning to them. So when I saw that you and your organization, the Walton Family Foundation, invest more than $250 million helping individuals find their life purpose, that made me smile. So the question is, what is the best way that parents and educators can help these students find their pathway so that they feel more engaged, they're excited about going to school, they're excited about learning, and optimistic about their future?
As you noted, Jay, every child is unique and on a unique path. And so what this research suggests and what we know is that the best thing that adults can do, parents and educators, is listen and really try to tailor solutions and supports to an individual young person's needs. especially in school, that sense of personalization and agency, that a young person has choices that fit what their interests are and what their needs are, matters a lot. And so at the Walton Family Foundation, we're passionate about thinking about how school can be a place that gives young people those choices and lets them be in the driver's seat of their own future.
And that future doesn't necessarily have to be what it was like when I was growing up, where you were told you're going to graduate high school, you're going to college, and then you're either going to graduate school or some kind of professional school, and that's what you're going to do. Now, there are opportunities for vocational pathways that may provide more satisfaction for the Gen Zer and perhaps more money.
That's right. And one thing we learned from this survey is that young people are hearing a lot about college options, but they're hearing less about career options. And so how do we make school a place that sets young people up for multiple pathways to their future? College may be the right path for many students, and also it may not be the right path for some students. And so how do we make sure they know and are exposed to pathways directly into careers or ways to earn credentials that will set them up for long-term career success?
Now, you said something earlier in our conversation that I want to come back to. You had talked about finding an adult you trust to be able to talk to. And sometimes it's not that easy to talk to your parents and maybe not even your teachers. The question I want to pose to you is, should professional talk therapy be afforded to everyone in this age group? And if the answer is yes, how can we afford it? Because it's expensive.
Well, one thing we learned from this survey is that young people value mentors. And so I think we need to look across the spectrum at all of the types of adults in people's lives, counselors, educators, mentors, parents, and no one adult, I think, can meet a student's needs. But how do adults work as teams to support students? And when you think about sort of the role of a counselor in supporting a young person, that has to be happening in a way that's integrated with the needs of the whole child. And so there has to be a connection to the student's academic experience and also to their home experience.
Absolutely. Romy Drucker is the director of the educational program at the Walton Family Foundation. We thank you for joining us today. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Jay Fox.
Here in Columbus, the Mount Carmel Health System has modified its consumer outreach to rely more heavily on reviews. National Leave a Review Day was back on October 22nd, and Reputation, the global leader in reputation performance management, is sharing data from a new survey on the importance of online reviews. Reputation CEO Joe Burton joins us now to discuss the importance of these reviews and what the research told them about consumer buying habits. So, Joe, why are online reviews so important?
Jay, thanks for having us. A survey of 2,000 consumers across the U.S. to really understand how they make purchasing decisions. And one of the key findings is that online reviews are more influential than any other one factor, more influential than the company's marketing, more than influencers, more than recommendations from family and friends. In fact, reviews were the single most influential factor, more than every other factor combined. It really was an incredible finding.
How do we know whether the reviews are real or manufactured?
You know, it is a great question, and reviews are so important, with so many consumers really relying on reviews being correct to assist them in their buying journey. We have to know. used to be easy to spot a fake review due to things we've all seen: incorrect grammar, weird spelling, misuse of capital letters. But AI improvements have led to well-written, coherent, but yet artificial reviews. It's becoming a real problem that 53% of consumers are concerned about. Fortunately, AI can spot AI. So a strategic, careful use of AI from a company like Reputation or others can spot those AI-generated reviews and flag them as such, so businesses and consumers can really see true opinions versus fake ones.
So we think about when consumers go to buy something. Typically, it could be a car, it could be going to the grocery store, it might even be sampling a restaurant. What other industries have been impacted by these reviews?
You know, one of the really surprising findings from this survey and other work that we've done is that almost all buyer journeys today start online. Almost every buyer journey starts with basketball shoes near me, good pickup trucks near me. Online, they want to see those merchants, and very quickly they move over and want to look at the reviews. People do this when renting an apartment, selecting replacement windows, buying a pair of boots. Reputation has customers in over 2,000 industries, and they all care about online reviews as a crucial part of the buying journey.
So let's talk about healthcare. One of the hospitals in Columbus is moving, as we mentioned at the beginning of the segment, to more consumer outreach through reviews rather than traditional advertising like TV and radio spots, billboards, magazine articles, you know, newspaper, things of that nature. How has this affected Mount Carmel's success in Columbus?
I was really smiling when I saw Mount Carmel come up as such a great promoter and user of this. I'm an Ohio boy myself, so it's always good to see one of the locals doing a great job with
Okay, wait a minute. Wait.
Yeah.
Where's home?
Yeah.
Where is home?
Home is been gone a while, but a quick shout out to the family and friends in Bellbrook, Ohio, down by Dayton, born and raised there.
Got it. Southwest Ohio. All right. So Mount Carmel, what happened?
You know, Mount Carmel, great hospital, takes care of their customers. Mount Carmel went down this path where they started asking their customers for reviews. Can you write a review online? Can you tell us what how we did? Initially, this seems very scary, but I love that they want to know. Mount Carmel asks consumers to leave a review, good or bad, and they answer everyone. Every review that gets left, they answer it, really engage their customers. And this next part isn't about Mount Carmel, but one of the great findings is that when somebody leaves a bad review and a company comes in and clearly answers it and makes it right, they come in, they apologize, they dialogue with the user, invite them in for so they can fix the problem, give a coupon, whatever's appropriate in this particular case. It turns a bad review into a super good review. Consumers love seeing a company that engages and takes care of their customers, and Mount Carmel just did a great job with this. So we love them.
Conflict resolution is an important part of the journey, because not everybody's going to have a good experience, and not everybody's going to believe that one company or another, regardless of the industry, is the perfect company that never makes mistakes. It seems completely implausible.
Well, That's right. People like to deal with people. People want a great product. They want great service. They want to be treated fairly. When they see an expression of that online, it really helps give comfort. 80% of consumers, regardless of their generation, like seeing that conflict resolution, and it actually drives them towards a business more than something that makes the business look a little too perfect, if you will.
So why do we need a National Lever Review Day? It was back on October 22nd. Why is that so important, and what happened?
You know, it's so important in order to drive awareness. Already today, 92% of consumers leave at least one online review per year. What we really were trying to drive with National Leave a Review Day back in October was this idea that on this day, can we get everyone to leave at least one review? And my goodness, if you are a business and you're not paying attention to your online reviews, it's a great day to get started interacting with the good ones, the bad ones, and really engaging your customers in a different way. Even though the day was last month, feel free to start leaving those reviews today. The companies need to hear from you, and it allows you to engage much, much better.
Joe Burton is the CEO of Reputation. We thank you for joining us. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, here's Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV.
In Washington, D.C. this weekend, the peaceful transfer of power is in the works as former president is getting ready to become our next president. Meanwhile, here in Ohio, we're also seeing another political shakeup beginning to unfold. Thanks for joining us for Face the State. I'm Doug Petcash. This election day had some people celebrating as others are left questioning how this all happened. From President-elect Donald Trump's big wins in key battleground states to Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown's re-election loss. Plus, voters rejected Ohio's only statewide initiative, Issue 1, after many experts believed it would pass with bipartisan support. And our state Supreme Court now becoming a 6-1 Republican majority, as two Democratic justices lose re-election and Republicans win all three races. Joining me now to break down all of the big developments from election night are longtime Republican strategist Terry Casey and longtime Democratic strategist and former Ohio Chief of Staff for late Senator John Glenn, Dale Butlin. Gentlemen, thank you for joining me today.
Good to be here.
Well, first of all, let's get right to this. I guess just what happened, Terry, in the sense that former President Trump was able to secure such a comfortable victory ultimately?
Well, part of it focusing in on Ohio. When you look at the six largest urban counties in Ohio, they only turned out at 66% compared to in the more Republican mid-sized rural counties where they were in the 70 to 77%. So part of it was turnout. There just wasn't the enthusiasm on the Democrat side, particularly among younger voters, urban minorities. So turnout was one of the big factors.
Are you talking about Ohio or nationwide?
I'm looking more at Ohio, but I think a lot of that was also true nationally. And also, there's some pollsters and some media people who predicted everything being so close who clearly didn't have a feel for what was really happening out there.
Dale, what do you think happened?
Well, first, let me say that this was, to use a highly technical term, an old-fashioned butt-kicking. I know many of my fellow Democrats are despondent today, but let me just say this to them. This is sad. It's depressing. But when you've been around politics as long as I have, you know that in a democracy, there are no permanent wins or losses. Trump's going to have a chance to enact pretty much everything he wants. But if voters don't like what they get from him, which I suspect may be the case, we're going to have a chance to reshuffle the deck in 2 years during the midterm elections. So let me leave that aside. What happened? Democrats are tempted to point to a lot of different things. It was a racism, sexism, where people didn't want to vote for a woman, let alone a black woman. Did Biden drop out too late? All the rest. I think the biggest single reason is Kamala Harris was Joe Biden's vice president at a time when, rightly or wrongly, 70% of the American people think the economy is doing poorly, and 70%, over 70%, say the country was on the wrong track. Those are enormous headwinds that would sink almost any candidate who was part of that administration. And I think it's remarkable in many ways she came as close as she did.
Why was Bernie Moreno able to secure basically a four-point victory over a longtime incumbent, Sherrod Brown, who is well-known here in Ohio?
Well, part of it was Trump, because he didn't just get 8% win in Ohio. It was like
11
and a half, roughly. But also the turnout, as I mentioned. But the other factor is, with nearly $500 million spent in Ohio, Sherrod had plenty of money, but he tried to, as Tim Ryan did 2 years ago and failed, to be Trump light, because he tried to associate and say, I'm with Trump on some things, blah, 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 blah. And I don't think people really believe that. And also, when you've been there that long, because when I looked at the Emerson poll that was done right before Election Day, Bernie Moreno was doing some things different, with women doing better than average compared to the other polling. There was young and old versus differences there. But Sherrod, like a lot of politicians, sometimes you hit your used-by date, and I think people are ready to shift. But again, as Dale mentioned, a lot of it was about people wanting change, not happy with what happened in the last 4 years.
So you may recall, I said on this show several weeks ago that the chances of Sherrod's winning depended almost entirely on the size of Trump's winning margin in the state. The last two times Trump ran, he carried Ohio by 8 points. I said on this show,
I said on this show that
if Harris could hold Trump's winning margin down to maybe 5, 6, 7 points, Sherrod had a real shot. As it turns out, that was absolutely right. Sherrod only lost by 4 points in a year that Trump won this state by 11 points. You have to depend. Obviously, look, if Trump's going to carry the state, that by definition means for Sherrod to win, too, some of the people voted for Trump have to vote for Sherrod. Well, that's just too many ticket splitters to count on. That doesn't happen much anymore. The last time in this state where voters put a candidate from one party in the White House, or voted for one candidate in the White House and a candidate from a different party in the Senate, was 36 years ago in 1988. Ticket splitting doesn't happen anymore. And yet Sherrod came within 4 points in a year, as I say, that Trump carried the state by 11. Those headwinds were just too strong for Sherrod to survive.
Ohio's going to have two new senators. Governor DeWine's going to have to pick a replacement appointment for J.D. Vance's seat as he moves to be vice president. Terry, what are you thinking ideologically the type of person Governor DeWine might be looking for to fill that seat?
Well, a little over a week ago, I spent about 20 minutes with Mike DeWine, and I said, you're going to be very popular this past week. And one of the funny things is he's gotten, both before the election and after, a lot of calls from county commissioners and mayors of nice communities and small towns who say, boy, I'd like to cap my resume by being appointed senator. What the governor's looking for is somebody that can serve well in the Senate, because remember, he had 12 years as a U.S. senator. He knows how important that is for Ohio. But also, he wants somebody that can win in 26, both a primary and a general, because then they've got to turn around and run again in 28. So I think he holds his cards very close. He's a good listener. He's popular. Lots of people are talking to him. But by the way, it's pretty clear from talking to both of them, neither the lieutenant governor or the attorney general, they're focused on governor, not on being appointed senator. So there's some names out there. But again, the governor's getting lots of other names from people that would think that looked nice on my resume.
And Dale, obviously it's not going to be a Democratic senator right now. So I guess, what are your hopes in who the governor would select?
You know, I really don't have any thoughts on what he's going to do. I'll leave what the Republicans will do to Terry. He's a lot more well-versed in that than I. I would say that if what I've heard the governor say is that he's going to be most focused on who can win, you know, the next time out. And if that's truly the measure, I don't think that Frank LaRose has much of a shot.
Okay. There'll also be two brand new senators with no political, I can't say no political experience at this point, but brand new senators, so not an entrenched person who's in the Senate. How does that impact Ohio in terms of what will they will be able to accomplish for the state?
Well, they're both new, but they're going to have the ultimate head of the Senate kind of as the vice president. So Ohio's almost got three senators there, but they're all very new. And part of the question is how and where do they want to focus their efforts? And Bernie Moreno was talking the day after the election about wanting to talk to mayors in some of the large counties, some of the
who
things.
Who didn't support him.
Right, right. But he's reaching out. And I think that's important that you reach out and represent all of Ohioans, because the Senate, there's still going to be the filibuster rule and a lot of issues. It's going to take 60 votes. So there's going to need to be some bipartisanship and focusing on some of the issues. But clearly, things like drilling more, producing more energy as a way to fight inflation, to help our country, those are issues that are going to be part of his interests.
Dale, what do you think about a sense of, you know, the being brand new in the Senate with both senators?
Well, it's very difficult when you're a freshman. It's even more difficult when you come in with no government experience, which is what we're going to have with regard to Senator Moreno, Senator-elect Moreno, who has spent his entire life selling cars. He's had no government experience at all. So I think he's going to look, as Terry said, I think he's going to look to the Senate leadership to tell him how to vote, and I'll be shocked if he doesn't do exactly what they tell him.
I want to, with the time we have left, I do want to touch on issue one here. It looked like there was a lot of popular support for it. It ended up failing, I believe, by 8 or 9 points ultimately. This, of course, is the proposed constitutional amendment that would have switched the current redistricting commission to a citizens commission. Dale, what do you think happened here that led to the failure of the issue one proposal?
Two things. Despite massively outspending the no side, which the yes side did, and despite the fact that Ohioans have said over and over again they don't like gerrymandering, issue one went down. Well, it went down for two reasons, in my judgment. Number one, I think the Republicans who were on the no side cleverly manipulated the ballot language to confuse voters into thinking that voting yes somehow meant you were voting for gerrymandering, when in fact the absolute opposite was true. Equally important, I think, was their decision to turn issue one into a referendum on Donald Trump. Because however much Ohioans may hate gerrymandering, they love Donald Trump even more. And so when that happened, I think that was enough to turn the tide.
I agree in part with what Dale said, but even though they had $38 million, the no side only had $8 million. That forced them to be more focused in their messaging. And clearly, when you write an amendment to the Constitution, 13,000 words, it creates confusion, doubt, and many people, when they're in doubt or have questions, they vote no. But clearly, I think it was a messaging failure on the yes side, because for all that money, I don't think they got much bang for their buck.
So what happens going forward? Do you think it's done, it's off the table, and it's going to stay this seven-member redistricting commission that is, you know, elected officials? Or perhaps, as Governor DeWine has said, maybe it needs to be tweaked to be more like Iowa?
Well, there's some different options, but it's very difficult on redistricting, because is your priority compactness of districts? Is it keeping communities whole? Is it competitiveness, where you set up some number that you're trying to aim for to get districts? Because Ohio demographically is very divided. People pick to live next to neighbors, whether it's in urban areas or rural areas. So this state is so big and so diverse, it's hard to draw up a perfect plan on all three categories.
Do you see anything changing, Dale?
I hope this is not the end for it, because for two reasons. Number one, gerrymandering rigs the system so that the outcome of elections are decided before they're even held. Secondly, it's one of those anti-majoritarian institutions that we have in this country that I think frustrate people. You know, when people say, oh, my vote really doesn't matter, in truth, it often doesn't. If by matter, you mean the government doing what people want it to do. And this is another one of those things that is anti-majoritarian in nature that I think is very harmful to our system.
Gentlemen, we're going to have to leave it there. The time always flies. I love talking to you both and getting your perspective on such a really a momentous election this time around.
Thank you.
Ohio's redistricting commission is staying in place. Ohioans shot down issue one on election day, with nearly 54% of voters going against the proposed constitutional amendment. The group behind issue one, Citizens Not Politicians, presented it as a solution to end gerrymandering in Ohio
by putting citizens in charge of making political maps instead of politicians. Those who supported Issue 1, including the group behind it, say they are disappointed, but they believe this campaign has given them a powerful foundation for the future.
Thousands and thousands of people who voted yes want to end gerrymandering in the state of Ohio. The statistics show that. There's absolutely no doubt. The people that voted no thought they were voting to end gerrymandering because of the manipulated language on the ballot.
We also heard from the group against Issue 1 after it was called. They told us why they believe Ohioans shot down the initiative.
The big issue that voters, I think, moved voters on this issue was accountability, that the Citizen Commission was going to appoint 15 people that could not be removed for gross misconduct. They were self-governing. Voters couldn't take them and had no accountability over the issue at all.
Citizens Not Politicians tells us that right now they do not have plans for another ballot initiative. Meanwhile, a big win for Republicans and a major shakeup on Ohio's Supreme Court. Every Republican won their race, giving them a 6-1 majority moving forward. Incumbent Republican Justice Joseph Dieters defeated incumbent Democratic Justice Melody Stewart. Dieters left his seat to challenge Stewart. His new 6-year term will start on January 2nd. In the race for Dieters' current seat, Republican Judge Daniel Hawkins defeated Democratic Judge Lisa Forbes. Hawkins will serve out the remaining 2 years left in Dieters' original term. And Republican Judge Megan Shanahan defeated sitting Justice and Democrat Michael Donnelly. Her 6-year term will start on January 1st.
Again, that's Doug Petcash, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV. From the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. Heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM ESPN Columbus.